Okay. Continuing with Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 2. The Lord in the Heart is the title of the chapter, and we were reviewing many things, and specifically the verse that we discussed was emphasizing the importance of the transcendentalist yogi to be free from desire, even the curiosity type of desire for material enjoyment or speculative knowledge. I wonder what this place is like. I wonder what that place is like. Once Prabhupada described like this, when the yogi leaves his body, the soul passes. Very similar description as is found in Brihat Bhagavatamrita. The soul passes through all the different planetary systems. And if the soul is fixed upon achieving the Supreme, the soul goes directly to the Supreme. But if the soul even has some curiosity going past such and such place, whoa, look at that place. I wonder what that place is like. The soul takes birth there. You wanted to find out what that place was like? Here it is. Have a whole lifetime to find out what that place is like. So the Bhagavatam is teaching us to not make that mistake. So it's anukulyasya sankalpa pratikulyasya varjanam. Completely accept those things which lead one closer to Krishna, and those things that do not do that, they're to be rejected. Or those of you that study Nectar of Devotion, in Nectar of Devotion, it's described there are different vidhis, rules and regulations to be observed in the practice of devotional service. Things that are enjoined to do and things that are enjoined not to do. And what's the essential principle behind all of them? Those things are to be done because of what reason? Or things are not to be done because of what reason? Nectar of Devotion. No reason, right? Just whimsical. Let's see if you can imagine what the reason is. Yeah. Okay. Any other idea? That's a nice idea. Yeah, pleasing Krishna. Pleasing Krishna. Always remember Krishna, never forget Krishna. That's the principle behind it. That which helps me remember Krishna, I'll do that. That which takes my attention away from Krishna, no thank you. The material, we'll go back again, this is still review. The material idea of advancement is what Prabhupada calls improved standard of living. The improved standard of living measure says a dog eats from the floor and you eat from a plate. So that's advancement. and the dog has sex in the street and you have some in your home. The activity is the same, but advancement is you do it in a polished way. The life of polished animals, eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. The animals defend with their teeth and their claws, and the animals and the humans defend with their bombs and missiles. Advancement of civilization is a polished way of doing the same things that the animal propensity demonstrates. That's not what advancement of civilization is. There's this measure of standard of living. People aspire after a higher standard of living, and that's their aim of life, is to have a higher standard of living. Until they realize what that higher standard of living cost is. The cost is values of life that they hold very dear. They have to abandon those values of life in order to get the higher standard of life. You get a lower standard of life to get the higher standard of life. Doesn't make sense, but that's the price. In my preaching in America, so many people take to Krishna consciousness that came from India for a higher standard of life, because when they came to America they found, what is this? And searching again for something that they could relate to of their culture and of their original value system, they started taking a deeper interest in Krishna consciousness. And explicitly, boy, you got a deep cough, huh? Anyway. Persons who received Bhagavad Gita from India, went to America, higher education, then met devotees and got Bhagavad Gita. I asked them, if you had received the same Bhagavad Gita in Bombay when you were going to school, would you have taken it seriously? To tell you the truth, Maharaj. And why not? Well, you know, I may have had some interest, but there's so many obligations and so many family things and so many, you know how it is, so much stuff. I might have read a little bit, but not become a serious practitioner. So when you're deprived of something that you value very much, you can understand its value even more. Now, for those of you that haven't had that, the ecstasy of deprivation, then you have to have a deeper understanding just because of the value of the thing itself. Runs in the family, huh? Hare Krishna. So the Bhagavatam is teaching us, whether it's deprivation by circumstance or taking the value system that you have in front of you for granted, that one should be very thoughtful. This is the instruction. Be very thoughtful about what is really important. And to understand what is really important, guidance is needed, because material nature dictates material happiness is important. We get a material body because we have material desires. And the body keeps reminding us of our material desires through all the different stages of life. For children, it's playing, and for young boys, it's school, and so on and so on and so on and so on. There's something always there before you as an object to attract your attention and try to pursue. Prahlad Maharaj describes this to his classmates. The material world is so designed, there's always something to distract you from the spiritual purpose of life. And so spiritual guidance is necessary to get to the spiritual essence and value of life. Even if someone understands there's something more to life than this, what that something more is requires guidance. So the Bhagavatam is giving that guidance. So even if one is very competent in yoga and meditation, one still needs guidance. What is the purpose behind that capacity? It should not be for achieving some material position. In the verse that we read, which was text 22, it mentions travel in outer space with the Vahayasas. Doesn't mention anything in the purport, but upcoming it will. So you can remember this word, Vahayasas. Vahayasa is, Prabhupada translates as the Milky Way. So I don't know how familiar that is in high school science here in India, the Milky Way. It's common, right? Milky Way. Okay. Here it is in the Bhagavatam, Vahayasas. It shows the path to Brahmaloka. And then above the Milky Way is the planet of the god of fire, who is Agni. And his planet is Vaishvanara. Vaishvanara Loka is above the Milky Way and on the way to Brahmaloka. And these verses are going to describe how one has to pass above the Vaihyasas, where people have all these mystic powers and they can do all these amazing things, to the planet of the god of fire, where one enters and becomes purified of all sinful reactions. Doesn't mean that tendency for more sinful things is taken away, but reactions to sins is eliminated, and then one goes to Brahmaloka. And mention is also made of the pole star, or Dhruvaloka. Now in the fourth canto there's some very interesting description I'll share with you about the pole star. On the pole star, or Dhruvaloka, there's an ocean of milk. Just like here we have, you know, which is that direction is the ocean? Which direction is the ocean? Which way is the beach? That way?
East.
This way. Over that way is the ocean. So that's a salt ocean. So on Dhruvaloka there's a milk ocean, and on the milk ocean there's a white island. The white island is Sweta Dvipa. And on that white island, who resides there? Who's on that white island? Shirodakshai Vishnu. Shirodakshai Vishnu. Shirodakshai Vishnu. And it's that Shirodakshai Vishnu that Dhruva was meditating upon, and he saw within his heart as Shirodakshai Vishnu. It's that same Shirodakshai Vishnu that the demigods approached. They went to the shore of the milk ocean and they pleaded with Shirodakshai Vishnu, "The universal breathing is choked up. What happened? Can't breathe." Because Dhruva had learned to suspend his breathing so that he was taking a breath every 15 days. Want to try it? And because his, not just because you can't do that materially, you die, you know, just by science, the carbon monoxide would increase, the amount of oxygen in the body would decrease, and you die. I mean, the soul would leave the body. The body can't function like that unless there's some higher order adjustment. And the higher order adjustment was consciousness fixed upon the personality of Godhead, just like we were discussing this morning. When one becomes Krishna conscious, one can do things that one ordinarily cannot do, like stop breathing. He can't do it and live. I mean, he stopped eating and he stopped drinking water. You can die from dehydration. He stopped drinking water. He stopped breathing. That's pretty mystical. But his consciousness was fixed upon Shirodakshai Vishnu. And so, because the Supreme Lord had manifested himself, his consciousness was totally absorbed in the Supreme Lord. That was sustaining, but spiritual energy was sustaining his life. And the demigods were suffocating. So the demigods went to the shore of the milk ocean, prayed, "Vishnu, Vishnu, help us. What's going on? This has never happened before." Vishnu said, "Don't worry, it's just a 5-year-old boy named Dhruva, and he's doing pranayama. But I'll go take care of it, don't worry." So Shweta Dweep is an island in the milk ocean that's on Dhruvaloka, and that planet is the planet where the Supreme Lord resides. It's that Lord Vishnu said to Dhruva that you'll go and reside there after you're king here for 36,000 years ruling this planet, and then you'll go to that planet and you'll remain eternally. You'll stay there even after this material world is annihilated, because that place isn't annihilated. So this is giving, these verses are giving us a little bit of the cosmography of the universe. In the language of the Bhagavatam, this is one of the 10 topics of the whole Bhagavatam. The arrangements of the planetary systems. It's discussed in the 5th canto, and there are pieces here and there in other cantos. This is one section. So this is the transit position of the yogis that don't go back to Godhead. They may go to these other places, or if they do go back to Godhead, they just keep going. So that's the consideration. If one has material desire, one has to experience the material world. One has no material desire, then one can go to the spiritual world. And there's no third position. As long as we have material desires, we're conditioned, we're held as responsible and accountable for those desires. And that's the nature of this place. It's abundantly providing objects to attract the attempt to fulfill those desires, to enjoy those objects. Get out there and enjoy those objects. That's the materially successful person is one who has many toys, and they can play with those toys as they like. So here's the verse. The transcendentalists are concerned with the spiritual body. As such, by the strength of their devotional service, austerities, mystic power, and transcendental knowledge, their movements are unrestricted, like the Vahayasas. They have mystic powers, they have all these things. The devotees have all these things. But they're not interested in fooling around with all these things. They may, for service to Krishna, use some of those things. They may not use some of those things. What's the determining factor of what you use and what you don't use? If it's going to please Krishna or not. Once Prabhupada was asked, Swamiji, do you have mystic powers? And Prabhupada said, look at all these Western boys and girls. There's mystic power. Before they were doing all abominable things, and now they've given up all those abominable things. Can any of you do that? But on another occasion, Prabhupada said that actually, to the devotees, he said, devotees naturally are endowed by Krishna with mystic powers, but they don't like to exhibit them. They don't like to exhibit them because ordinary persons will become covetous of mystic powers. Oh, I want that mystic power. Instead of wanting Krishna consciousness. So generally speaking, pure devotees do not like exhibiting mystic powers, but sometimes they do. There's many examples of this, the mystic power exhibition of pure devotees, but only in rare occasions would they do that. Associates of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would do such things, but that was out of ecstatic devotion. They were carried away with ecstatic devotion and would just do amazing things. When we were in Mayapur, we visited the Samadhi Mandir and Bhajan Kutir of Jagannath Das Babaji. And one very wealthy industrialist came to visit him and asked a similar question. Babaji Maharaj, do you have any mystic powers? And he, no. No mystic powers. I'm sorry, you'll have to find a great yogi. I have no such things, mystic powers. But then something happened all of a sudden. He said, he made some loud noise, and the person said, what was that? He said, in the bhajan kutir of he took a stick, he was chasing, like moving the stick and bashing the stick. He said, I'm chasing away the dogs that are eating the tulsi by the Bhajan Kutir of Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami at Radhakund. And so the industrialist, knowing how to do things, he sent a telegram. At that time they had telegram service. Sent a telegram to Radhakund because he knew somebody in Radhakund and asked, had it happened? And the message came back, it happened. That very moment that he was doing with the stick, chasing away the dogs. Sometimes great devotees will exhibit their mystic powers. Generally, Prabhupada explained, they don't, because then people want, they desire to attain the mystic power rather than attain pure devotion. Here in this canto, we're understanding that the back home, back to Godhead trajectory of the accomplished yogi who can meditate upon the Supersoul and by that meditation leave his body doesn't take birth or doesn't descend to any one of those planets. Prabhupada writes, within the material worlds, these yogis move in the planetary systems of Maharloka, Janaloka, Tapaloka, and Satyaloka, and beyond the material worlds. This is the residents, those who are in pure consciousness have this capacity. They can move into Vaikunthas as unrestricted spacemen. So Prabhupada gives the example of Narada Muni, he gives the example of Durvas Muni. Even he wasn't a great devotee, he was a great mystic, and Durvas Muni was able to travel in a period of 1 year's time all the way to Brahmaloka, all the way to Shivaloka, and all the way to Vaikunthaloka, or at least to the pole star within this universe, and back again in 1 year's time, because the description that's there in the fourth canto is, by the time Dhruva Maharaj returned with the Sudarshan Chakra in hot pursuit, one whole year had passed, because the arrangement was that there was a 1 year fast for Ekadasi that the king had undergone, and when it was time to break the fast, Durvas Muni came. So Durvas Muni went to take his bath, and before he completed his bath and came back, Ambarish Maharaj was to break the fast, but he hadn't come back yet. So after Durvas Muni was being pursued by the Sudarshan Chakra, a whole other year had passed, where Maharaj Ambarish resumed this austerity for a second year. On the same Ekadasi day, he came back again. And in that 1 year's time, all the way to Brahmaloka, so this is describing the travel of the yogi to Brahmaloka, just as Durvas Muni did. So the Brihad Bhagavatamrita makes it very, very clear, as Bhagavatam does too, that there's 14 planetary systems, correct? There's different ways of describing. There's three: upper, middle, and lower planetary systems. Heavenly planets, same as in Christian and Islam terminology. There's heaven, there's hell, and there's the in-between place where we are. And you're good, you go to the good place. You're bad, you go to the bad place. And if you like everybody else, you stay around here for a while. But another description, a more detailed description, is the 14 planetary systems. So those 14, there's 7 upper, 7 lower. And this earth is somewhere in the middle region of the 17. So Bhumandala, or Bhuloka, Bhuvarloka, Svargaloka, just as in Gayatri. Bhuvar, Svargaloka. Those are the three lower of the 7 upper planetary systems. and then Maharaloka, then Janaloka, then Tapaloka, then Brahmaloka. That's seven. So it's mentioned here that in this Maharaloka, that's above Svargaloka, above heaven, is the place where great sages who are grihasthas go, Maharaloka. Bhrigu resides. He's the priest of the heavenly planets in Svargaloka, but his residence is Maharaloka. And many other grihasthas who are very, very elevated above the desires of the heavenly pleasures, they're not attracted by heavenly pleasures. They're attracted by the performance, the happiness of the performance of yajna, where it's described in Brihad Bhagavatamrita that as they're offering oblations into the fire, they're such elevated souls that the Supreme Lord comes before them with his outstretched hands and receives their offerings personally. They see him. They personally make their offerings to him. He personally accepts. When the yajna is over, he disappears. So they like yajnas. They like the happiness of making those offerings to the Supreme Lord. Janaloka doesn't give as much detailed description, but it's above Maharaloka. And in those two planetary systems, when there's the night of Brahma, half of the universe is dissolved, so that in the morning he has to reconstruct it again. And the dissolving takes place in the following manner. There's a long period of no rain, drought. So everything becomes parched. And then there's a fire at the bottom of the universe. And when things are parched, they ignite very quickly. And those flames go up to and include Svargaloka. That means, you know, the host of demigods and their planets are annihilated at the end of each day of Brahma. But the heat is so intense, it cooks Maharaloka. So they get in their vimanas and they go beyond Janaloka to Tapaloka. They hang out there for a while, they come back again. Their planets are still there, they don't have to be reconstructed, but it's too hot. So they take off. And in Tapaloka, the residents of Tapaloka it's exclusively for Naishtika brahmacharis, for celibates. And the activity in Tapaloka is primarily meditation. Well, two things. Primarily meditation, and while they're meditating upon the Supreme Lord, they see the Supreme Lord constantly in meditation. The four Kumaras are actually residents of Vaikuntha, but they give their association to the residents of Tapaloka. And the Saptarishis, no, the Navayogendras, excuse me, the Navayogendras, the sons of King Prachinibari that entered into the lake under the order of Lord Shiva and performed their meditation and saw the Supreme Lord Vishnu. When they come out, they become the Navayogendras in the 11th canto. They instruct Maharaj Nimi, those first chapters of the 11th canto. Navayogendras, they reside, Pipalayan Rishi and so many other rishis. That's Tapaloka. Above Tapaloka is Satyaloka, where Lord Brahma resides. So many of the yogis go to Satyaloka. But of course, they don't have to go to Satyaloka. They can go directly to the spiritual world. But like you were pointing out, unless they're perfectly trained in devotion, they can't go to Vaikuntha Loka. They go to Brahmaloka, where purified souls that have no material desire and full attraction of spiritual understanding, they go there. So that's what this is describing. O King, when such a mystic passes over the Milky Way, this is the Vahayasa region, the Milky Way, by the illuminating Shushuma, to reach the highest planet Brahmaloka, he first goes to Vaishvanara, the planet of the deity of fire, when he becomes completely cleansed of all contaminations, and thereafter he goes to still higher, to the circle of Shishumar, to relate with Lord Hari, the personality of Godhead. So Shishumar is a circle that's described as being like the navel of the universal form of the Lord, and all the planets circumambulate around the Shishumar circle. And in the center of that circle is the pole star, meaning that all the planets keeping their right side to the pole star, they circumambulate the planet of Lord Vishnu within this universe. So by astronomy, the pole star is the pivot star around which all the celestial bodies move, and that's how calculations are made. Astronomical calculations are made in that way. So in Vedic language, the Shishumara circle is those series of planets that move around at the center of that, the whole universal planetary structure. That's there. They primarily keep their circular structure and keep circumnavigating around the pole star. So if you're not interested in astronomy, then you're not going to be interested in this discussion. But it's in the Bhagavatam, so we're discussing it. And just, you know, the complexity is great. Just a little news flash from Sridham Mayapur at our GBC meetings. There's been a committee formed. Rabindra Sarup Prabhu is heading that committee, and one devotee, Amataji, who has her PhD in astrophysics, is on the committee too, and several other devotees, and they're going to be working on making a plan once again for the planetarium that will be in Mayapur, because some persons, Sadaputta Prabhu has come out with a number of publications that are unlocking the secrets of the fifth canto, the structure of the universe. Some persons disagree with the understanding that he's come up with, and so now a group of scholarly devotees will be working on this, going to the original texts of the Vishnu Purana, original texts of the Mahabharata, original texts, just like here, these verses that we're reading that says where things are, and put them together with over there where it says where things are, and crack the mystery of the fifth canto as their assignment. Through very careful Sanskrit study and understanding, the very careful scrutiny of Prabhupada's purports and Bhaktisiddhanta's writings on these subjects. So if some of you are lost, don't worry, because it's a complicated subject. But it's the essential principle is that there are higher, and this is what Prabhupada is emphasizing in the next purport, there are higher realms, and how can the scientist who is depending upon his imperfect senses, who cannot even understand how his fingernails grow, or cannot understand how food digests, and so many other things, is going to understand the structure of the universe and life on other planets and so on. I just received a report that there's a, well, as part of a raging battle that's going on in America courtrooms today about intelligent design. Does that ring any bell with anybody? Anybody here know what that is about, intelligent design? A little bit. Okay. In public schools in America, there's, following the laws of the country, that you have to separate church and state. Separation of church and state. You've heard that before? The government should not mess with religion, and religion should not mess with the government. Because the Europeans that came to America were very oppressed by government leaders that used the church to help rule the people, and the government leaders that hooked up with, religious leaders that hooked up with government to help keep their membership, although neither were really qualified. It was a political arrangement from both groups, and being very unhappy with that decadence, particularly of the Catholic Church, the Protestant Reformation took place, European history, and part of that Protestant Reformation is many of those Protestants came to America for religious freedom, right? That history you know, right? For religious freedom. So those persons that founded the country said, government should not mess with our religious freedom. Separation of the state from matters of the church. So where that's gone to today is you cannot speak about God in schools. God is banned. You can't. Not to say he doesn't exist, but we just can't talk about God because there's separation of church and state. As soon as you start talking about God, then you got this group saying, no, you got to talk about God as this, no, you got to talk about God like that, and it becomes chaos. So you can't talk about God. So now comes science class, eighth grade science class. They have to teach how did things come into being. How did things come into being? Big Bang. And how are their varieties? Darwinian evolution. That's how their varieties. Don't talk about God. So now there's a group of scientists that say there should be a second model taught in schools today. One model says everything came about by chemical evolution, the Darwinian evolution. Life comes from matter. Darwinian evolution. There's another idea that should be taught in schools that says, you see, the design, the symmetry, the patterns, the details of nature, and there's intelligence behind this design, this pattern, just like outside. There's a nice painting, Rangoli painting on the floor. And it's not just that some dust came flying over the wall and landed in that pattern. If I had a projector, I would show you some very interesting pictures of people that are arguing in favor of design. It looks at an E. coli bacteria. Those of you who take an eighth grade science, you know what that is. Little guy, little single-celled living entity. It has a little flagellum, little tail in the back. So they've micro-analyzed how the flagellum works. And it's this series of chambers and pumps and pressure, and because pressure is applied, the little flagellum moves. So Darwinian evolution would say, this is just a single-celled living entity, that came about by random arrangements of matter. So some scientists are saying that's not very scientific. It's more scientific to say that just like, you know, it's even more sophisticated than a pump that you have to pump water to put up, you know, on the roof, and then it comes by gravitational feed. To take water out of the ground, you have to have some suction, and then it pumps the water up to the tank. Just to say that pump happened by chance. By random events of atoms bumping together, that pump that pumps water up onto the roof just came into being, it just evolved. And the single cell E. coli bacteria flagellum has a more complicated pumping system that it just came about by chance. It's more scientific. At least it's an alternative that should be taught in the public schools in America or any place, that there's a design behind this, and behind the design there's some intelligence. Now, what that intelligence is, we can't scientifically say, but that there's intelligence behind it is more sensible than to say there's two other alternatives. Intelligence did it, or just by the laws of nature, it had to happen that way. It couldn't have come out any way because it's the laws of nature. That's not a plausible explanation. What are the laws of nature that made that pump? That's just one example. Or by chance combination of atoms just bumping together in the right combination, it made it happen. And by mathematical probability theory, they can calculate what are the chances, and it's 10 to the 500th power. It means it's not going to happen. So there's this raging battle going on in America, in the courts, whether you can teach intelligent design as a side-by-side alternative with Darwinian evolution. And it's really sad or crazy that judges are going to decide. Did it happen this way or did it happen that way? They're going to say, we're not deciding whether it happened this way or that way. We're going to decide whether the Constitution of the United States permits the way that it really happened to be taught. Because of separation of church and state. And the scientists that are favoring intelligent design, they're saying, we're not speaking about a religious teaching, we're speaking about science. Anyway, it's going on in America today. The inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The pursuit of madness is happening. So in the, just like a little side note, is in the state of Utah, there's 50 states in the U.S. and one of them is the international headquarters of the Mormon Church in Utah, Salt Lake City. So the Mormon government, the state legislature in Utah, they wanted to pass a bill that says you cannot teach Darwinian evolution in the schools because it's unscientific. It didn't pass. They want to say you can teach two of them. So it's state by state because there are state rights. And here's what Prabhupada is saying. Now, I went through all of that exercise because it connects with what Prabhupada is writing in the purport. He's speaking about the duration of life in Maharloka and the duration of life in Brahmaloka because it's found within the verse itself. Here's the verse. At that time, the final devastation of the complete universe, that is the end of the duration of Brahma's life, a flame of fire emanates from the mouth of Ananta. Where is Ananta? He's at the bottom of the universe because on his hoods he's holding up the universe and the planets within the universe. So he's at the bottom. And flame comes out and it's parched because it's been a drought by the Lord's arrangement. And the whole universe goes up into flames. The yogi sees all the planets of the universe burning to ashes. And thus he leaves Maharloka for Satyaloka by airplanes used by the great purified souls. The duration of life in Satyaloka is calculated to be 100,000 million billion, 15,480,000,000,000 solar years. Now, who can prove that true or false? You can't. Nobody's around long enough to verify. But it's the difference. This is scriptural knowledge, that descending knowledge. You know, Prabhupada's commenting that these are very specific numbers with very specific procedures for travel between planets that we cannot do, but others can do. And then great acharyas have accepted these statements. Of course, the compiler of all the Vedas, the literary incarnation himself, Vyas, wrote this verse. But then, aside from his authority, Sridhar Swami, Ramanujacharya, Balabhacharya, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, great souls like Shukadeva Goswami, and so on. Then he writes, in the creation of the Lord, there are many wonderful things. We can see with our own eyes every day and night, but we aren't able to reach them equipped by modern materialistic science. We can see these heavenly bodies, but what's there we don't know, and nor will we be able to go there. We should not therefore depend on the fragmentary authority of materialistic science for knowing things beyond the range of scientific purview. And those are things that we can see, what to speak of things we cannot see. Just like in the beginning of the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, the first few verses of the 10th chapter, first 7 verses of the 10th chapter, describe very clearly a very common sense thing. And that is, for things that are created, it is not possible, there's no capacity to know their source of origin, their ultimate source of origin. It's not possible. You can't go back in a time machine. Jules Verne wrote a book about the time machine, so you can go back in time and know things that happened previously. But it was science fiction. You can't go back in time to know about things that happened before you existed. It's just very simple. You cannot know such things. Speculative methods are trying to, by reason and logic, intuitively understand. If this existed, then prior to this, that must have existed. Based upon by inference, by logic. Logic and reason. But that's not a way to know something. You can't know one way or the other way. And that's one of the arguments that the intelligence by design, or design by intelligence rather, intelligent design people are arguing. How do you know? How do you know? Well, it's scientific. What do you mean scientific? That everything, there's a big explosion, or that matter evolves. Anyway, that gets into very complicated. That there's micro changes, mutations over time, does not, that bit of scientific evidence does not mean that the origin of life is chemicals. And the the source of the patterns is those micro changes. And how can you know? Anyway, it's a hot debate. So Prabhupada writes that for a common man, both modern science and Vedic wisdom are simply to be accepted, because none of the statements of either modern science or of Vedic literature can be verified by him. The alternative for a common man is to believe either of them or both of them. And the intelligent design folks are saying both should be presented in the classroom. The modern scientists are saying no, it's against the law to present that there's intelligence behind the patterns of life. Not speaking of where that intelligence is from, but it's inferring that there's a supreme being, and you can't have that in the classrooms, you can't have that in state functions, because education comes from taxpayers' money. That's a state function. Church and state have to be separate. So you have to teach people ignorance, according to the laws of our country. There's a basic flaw in democracy. There's a number of them. That's one of them. Now, the British system doesn't have that same mandate. And so, in the UK, the government just allocated $14 million for establishing the first Hindu school in the UK. And the organizers of it are, guess who? The Hare Krishna Temple. The government is giving money of taxpayers to foster that particular view, because they don't have separation of church and state. And the British system is here in India. But that British system is not in America. And vigorously, the domineering mentality of American government is to make other people like them, homogenized. It's very dangerous. Very, 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 many ways, very dangerous. Then Prabhupada concludes by saying that of the two choices, one is a superior choice in principle. The superior choice in principle is where knowledge is not dependent upon fallible senses and imperfect reasoning capacity. If you want to have guaranteed imperfect knowledge, use that system. And taking knowledge from the infallible source is the superior system. That's the Vedic system. It gives us comprehensive empiric, in the sense of quantifiable knowledge. How many, Prabhupada often quoted the verse that says how many species there are in the of aquatics, 900,000 aquatics and 2 million insects and so many birds and so many animals in exact numbers and so many species of humans. Where's the scientist that can count all those species of plants and get them all? And it's not possible, because many of them are outside of this planet, not available on the Earth planet. So where can you get such knowledge except descending knowledge? This is a very wonderful subject for devotees that have, you know, academic training. This is what the Bhaktivedanta Institute was intended for. Persons who have that scholastic training or academic training, to use the tools of academia to demonstrate why the spiritual understanding is superior and why the speculative material science understanding is inferior from A to Z, from top to bottom. Prabhupada pushed the cause, championed the cause of Bhaktivedanta Institute, or this type of preaching, very, very much. Why? In short, because intellectuals lead, the head leads the rest of the body. And if the intellectuals have a gross misunderstanding of the way things are, the whole society becomes disturbed. As Prabhupada is writing in the next purport, we'll discuss it tomorrow morning because we're running out of time. But to understand spiritual knowledge, one must be situated in the quality of goodness. Conversely, if one is not situated in the quality of goodness, one will not be able to understand spiritual knowledge. Very simple. And to come to that stage where one has brahminical quality, it requires training. And that's what we're getting. Training. Regardless of background or birth, we're getting training in Vaishnava principles. And Vaishnava principles, regardless of your propensity for work, trains one in brahminical quality, or the quality of goodness. It promotes the quality of goodness through training. Prabhupada explains that by birth everyone has their particular occupation. By guna and karma, we take a body. And according to the influence of guna and karma, we have some occupation. And the only way that that's going to change is if there's training through Krishna consciousness. That one promotes the quality of goodness by directing our attention to Krishna and living our life with purity in principle according to our position. That transforms the quality. It builds character on the foundation of the spiritual platform. That's the message of Srimad Bhagavatam. That's the training that we're getting. Whatever our quality may be, just like I was mentioning this morning, or I mentioned this, that the miracle of transforming fallen souls into Vaishnavas. It's mystical. It's truly mystical. Because when you take up devotional service, you're given contact or shelter in the internal potency where there's protection from all the forces of guna and karma. It's shelter. Where you don't have to act according to impulsive tendency, but you can be in the shelter of Krishna tendency and act according to Krishna's desire. And that lifts our consciousness, it lifts our quality, it lifts our behavior, our speech, our whole personality becomes transcendental by spiritual contact. That's the Bhagavad Dharma method. So, back to the context, and I'll end. The yogi who's progressively lifting the prana, the life air, through the different energy centers, chakras within the body, and is leaving the body and is traveling through space, the configuration of the places, the planets within the upper regions of space are understood. One goes to Maharloka. When the devastation of the universe takes place, then one goes to Satyaloka or Brahmaloka, and then along with the residents of Satyaloka, Brahmaloka, one can go to the spiritual world. That's this gradual progression of those that have not yet perfected their lives in devotional service. Better to take the direct method. This practice, dedication of all things unto the personality of Godhead. So that's the next chapter. But this is the next step after developing a conception that God exists. Okay, so any discussion on these points? Mm-hmm. Go ahead, try. Try it again now.
Just like Earth planet, Bhumandala, upper planet is... Upper planetary system is called heaven. Lower one is hell.
There's heaven and there's hell, or upper planets, lower planets.
Upper one is considered heaven, and yeah. Lower planets are hell.
Yeah.
Similar conception also exists to those planets which are above. Those above them is heaven, and that lower one is hell. Like if we consider a planet which is situated above Earth.
I'm not sure what you're asking. There's Svargaloka is the technical term for heaven.
Yeah.
In between us and Svargaloka, there's another region. Bhuvar Loka.
Yeah. So if we consider like above Svargaloka also there are planets.
Above Earth there's planets, and above even heaven there's planets.
So is there a similar conception exist in Svargaloka people also that they
for
can,
which people?
For those who are residents of Svargaloka.
For those who are heading for Dhruvaloka?
Those who are residents of Svargaloka.
The residents of Svargaloka.
That if they come down, Earth is like a hell for them.
No, it's there's gradations of the modes of nature. There's more the mode of goodness, there's more the mode of passion, there's a mix of passion and ignorance, and then there's ignorance. And hell is not the same as this place. Although there are hellish conditions on this planet, there's also heavenly like conditions on this planet, and there's in between places on this planet. There are places that are more passionate. You know, to come here, I passed through Calcutta. Man, that's passion. Raw passion. Non-stop raw passion. It's more passionate than New York. Passion, 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 passion. And then there are places that are just hellish. And anyway, even within, you know, Calcutta, there's places that are more delightful, and there's places that are more hellish, and places that are more passionate. Anyway, so it's not the same. It's relatively unpleasant, but it's not the same unpleasant as the hellish planets.
Maharaj, in the light of the Ishopanishad verses, which say that those who proclaim to teach religion and they teach something in the name of religion, something is wrong, are worse than those who say that we don't follow religion but we teach something else, avidya.
Yeah.
So, as devotees, how should we look at this this intelligent design argument? Because those who are propounding the argument, they are also, they don't have a conception of God, which is...
There's different groups of them. Within those proponents, there's subdivisions. Some know very well. Some are agnostic. Some are just scientists. This makes more sense than that. I mean, so one of the arguments of, oh Krishna, I forget, a Harvard professor that was one of the original proponents of this intelligent design, he had a theory. And the theory was that aliens from upper planets came to this planet. Higher intelligent beings came to this planet and, you know, created varieties here by design. Now, that doesn't answer the question, where do those beings of higher intelligence come from? But he was just speaking about this planet. And it's based upon some scientific research that was done by technology to receive signals with these dishes they have, and there was codes, there were patterns in the signals they were picking up. So where there's patterns, the understanding in science is there's an intelligence behind the pattern. So you know how speculative scientists can get. Those that are atheist proponents of intelligent design, and there's theists that are proponents of intelligent design, and there are persons that are agnostics that are proponents of intelligent design, and then there's subsets of those. Hare Krishna. So your question is,
Is it indicating a positive direction, or should we think
wet stool, dry stool? You know, from a relative perspective, if someone becomes a vegetarian, that's better than they're a meat eater. From a relative perspective, it's better that intelligent design is allowed to be taught in the classrooms than Darwinian chemical evolution. Better that someone speaks nicely than nasty. Goodness is better than ignorance and passion. But what our concern is that the proper understanding behind this be made clear. And the means of having the proper understanding, that is descending knowledge, be made clear. Because if the methodology that's relied upon is pratyaksha and anuman, direct sense perception and or logic and reason, fallible conclusions are inevitable. Anything else? Yes. Microphone over there.
Maharaj,
yoga system is applicable only on earthly planets, or it is there on even higher planetary systems? Kali Yuga and
Kali Yuga is there on the higher planetary systems. I just heard Prabhupada describing that. Influence is less severe, but it's something like, you know, when there's the fire of devastation during the night of Brahma, it also affects the upper planetary systems. So yes.
So then Sankirtan movement is applicable for all the planetary systems in Kali Yuga?
I don't know. I have not heard Prabhupada say about that. It stands to reason. I don't know of anything definitive. Anything else? Yes?
How can individual soul be so powerful that he is able to generate fire because of his austerities?
I couldn't understand. Can you understand?
For example, how as a jiva soul, he was so powerful that he could create a...
Oh, he was invested with the power of the Supreme Lord. That's how. He became empowered by the Supreme Lord. The jiva soul is dependent and tiny. The Supreme Lord is unlimited and independent. The Supreme Lord placed himself subordinate to the living entity, Dhruva, because he's independent, he can do that. And he did that. So Dhruva became heavy like the Supreme Lord. Breathing became like the breathing of the Supreme Lord. When Dhruva stopped breathing, the universe became choked. Dhruva was more powerful than the demigods by the power of the personality of Godhead. He who was on this lower earth planet was able to control the movements of air in the universe more than the demigods, who were controllers of the elements of the universe. The demigods, they're also jivas, and they control the affairs of the creation, right? They administrate what goes on and what doesn't go on. Dhruva is a jiva soul also, but his power surpassed even their power. Huh? He became very powerful, but not the same principle. I mean, ultimately the power of Hiranyakashipu came from the same place that Dhruva's power came from, came from the same place that Prahlad's power came from, comes from the same place that everyone's power comes from. In that sense, the same. But in Hiranyakashipu's case, it was not because of his dearness to the Supreme Lord. It was because of his austerities, which entitled him to some kriti, but he wanted to use that kriti in a duskriti way. So demons become powerful also by their austerities. Dhruva became powerful by his austerities plus his devotion. But both were there. He had control of his senses, but by the grace of Narada, he also had fixed his devotion upon the personality of Godhead. that clear? Anything else? Okay.
Maharaj, when it is said that Prabhupada's books will be the law books for the mankind for the coming 10,000 years, in what way should we understand that the whole world will get to accept Prabhupada's books, or is it...
No, it means it's the standard of knowledge. And just a footnote on that point, this statement that is often quoted, the law books for the next 10,000 years, it's not a Mahavakya. It's not a principal utterance that Prabhupada said again and again and again and again and again. It's something that he said on some occasions. So it's taken, the followers of Srila Prabhupada have taken great notice of that and have made it a principal utterance. And it should be that the followers within ISKCON accept Prabhupada as the founder Acharya. Prabhupada explained this very clearly. Following him, there may be many Acharyas, but there's only one founder Acharya. That means the Acharyas should follow the conclusions established and the mood established by the founder Acharya. Something like the way that Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu accepted the commentary of Sridhar Swami of Srimad Bhagavatam, that's the standard. And anything that's written about Srimad Bhagavatam should follow the line of Sridhar Swami. Similarly, whoever is within ISKCON at least, any writing that's done should follow the line of Srila Prabhupada's teachings, as much as Srila Prabhupada would follow the line of Rupa Goswami, like that. Rupanugas or Prabhupadanugas become Rupanugas.
Maharaj, while doing occupational duty, we are also while doing our occupational duty.
When you're doing your occupational duty,
so we are basically teaching avidya, because.
Why do you say that? It depends on your consciousness. You heard his question, right?
So what?
You can have the right conclusion with the wrong consciousness, or the wrong conclusion with the right consciousness. The evaluation of your superiors in your workplace may be that you use certain methodologies and certain standards and so forth and so on, and you learn those. But what's your consciousness behind them? That determines whether it's, in principle, the cultivation of avidya. If I'll read the definition that Prabhupada gave us this morning. A desire to serve the Lord, the Supreme Predominator, is spiritual or transcendental. And one has to attain this purification of mind and senses to get admission into the spiritual kingdom. Now, by definition, if I accept what you said, then you're following a path which is going to keep you from entering the spiritual world. Is that a true or false conclusion? Okay. So now, you know, the delicate responsibility of someone who's a householder that has some occupation in this world has to have an understanding of utilizing a thing, that is your career, in service to Krishna. And the knowledge that goes along with that career. In many cases, not all cases, it's some form of technology. It's some form of push and pull, and you get an outcome. And you just do that. And some persons experiment, new pushes and new pulls, causes and effects. And that's called research. But that, so if it stays on that platform, then it's avidya. But so the challenge for the householder that has his career in that world is to do that which you do for Krishna only. According to Sri Brahma Samhita and the purports of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, the purifying effect of one's occupation, when joined properly with hearing and chanting, has the same purifying effect as the hearing and chanting. It's in relation to Lord Brahma's creating the universe. So we're not in the business of creating universes or in the business of something else. But whatever that something else, both of them are material. Avidya. It becomes spiritual if it's placed in relation to Krishna and it's executed in the consciousness of doing it in relation to Krishna. So that's a challenge, how to do that. That's a challenge, how to live your life in relation to Krishna. How to have a wife and a child in relation to Krishna and not in relation to sense gratification. That's a challenge. It's the challenge of having a material body. Whichever way you do it. It's not that the order of sannyas is spiritual. It's also material. It's on the material platform. And so sannyas ashram is on the material platform. Grihastha ashram is on the material platform. Brahmacharya ashram is on the material platform. They're not spiritual. It's the consciousness with which one executes the duties of that position, make this spiritual or not. And yes, it's very complicated, more complicated in the Grihastha ashram than it is in the sannyasa ashram. Definitely more complicated. Is it more easy? I would say it's a challenge to perform occupational duties in the sannyasa ashram properly as it is a challenge to perform the duties of Grihastha ashram properly. One has to act from that position which one is most suited for and then carry out those duties in a responsible manner. Different sets of challenges, ashram specific.
So can I say, if I understood it properly, while we are doing our occupational duty, although we may not be directly speaking about Krishna or anything related with Krishna, the consciousness of the individual who is actually performing that occupational duty,
yes,
is an imperceptible process. We cannot physically. It's a
yes.
Something which is
you've not understood correctly. To do it is another thing. But the understanding is correct. Read text 61 in Sri Brahma Samhita, purport. in detail is explained. Psychological, emotional, physical and social needs. Joined with practices of sadhana bhakti, he uses the term guna bhakti, as in guna. There's a typographical error. In one place it says jnana, but it should be guna bhakti. One place it's guna, the other place it's jnana. It's guna bhakti, meaning devotion that's it's involved with material nature, the modes of nature. It's the consciousness behind those activities that elevates the activity and elevates one, does not further entangle one in the complexities of material nature. But if that consciousness is missing, you certainly become implicated in the complexities of material nature. And the reactions. And it hurts. And it's very bewildering. The next verse speaks of how Vaikuntha residents that have full contact with the Supreme Lord, they can come to this realm and there's no bewilderment. They can move about and do so many things and never become implicated. Tomorrow's verse. And that consciousness can become our consciousness. Okay. How can parents cultivate a relationship of love and trust with their children, with Guru and Krishna in the center? That's really not, it's a nice question, it's not on subject. I would say, in a short answer, if the parent has that consciousness of their life being with Guru and Krishna in center, it naturally flows that the relationship with the children will be with Guru and Krishna in the center, because the children mold their lives or imitate in so many ways the character, the behavior and patterns of speech and so forth of the parents. So do the same things that you do with your children, and the qualities that you carry will be passed on to your children with Guru and Krishna in the center. Yes. Microphone.
Maharaj said that seeing God in nature is to see God in heart. So at my level, how should I begin to see God in heart?
I think we need better speakers. I couldn't follow. Seeing God in nature?
Seeing the Lord within one's heart.
No. Seeing God within nature is chapter 1. Seeing God within the heart is chapter 2. It's not one chapter. Seeing God within nature, there's different ways of seeing God within nature. The way that's mentioned in the first chapter is to see the rivers are his veins, the hills are his stacks of his bones, the clouds and the sky are his tufts of hair, the moon and the sun are his two eyes, the trees are his hairs standing on his body. Seeing things of nature in relation to the body of Virat Rup. There are other ways of seeing God within nature, and that's just the beauty and the serenity of nature. Of course, you get really close and you see nature can be very vicious. It's, you know, survival of one species devouring another species in sometimes very brutal ways. but you know, take away that brutality and you know the beauty of a something within nature. It's awesome. There's a awe-inspiring sense of the grandeur of some power greater than us. So those are, and others, ways of seeing God within nature. And seeing God within the heart is very specific. It's a spiritual form with certain features of that form. Certain shape and ornaments and objects and so forth. And fully spiritual, not made of material elements, but fully spiritual composition. It's completely distinct. Anything else? Last question.
Maharaj, it seems a little surprising that people in the higher planetary system seeing the Vishnu directly, but still they're
in Maharloka, they're seeing, and Tapaloka, they're seeing the Lord directly.
Is it
within the mind in Tapaloka? And the argument that Pipalayana Rishi gives to Gopal Kumar is that seeing, you're looking for God. Why are you looking for God? Just stay here in Tapaloka. We're seeing God all the time. He gives an argument that seeing God means seeing Him within the mind. It's a long, drawn out thing. But that's what he's saying. Even when you see something else, you know that it's for real because it registers in your mind, and therefore seeing with the mind is the same as seeing, and therefore just meditate and see within the mind. But it's not the same. There's one sense it's the same, but another sense it's not the same. Because the activities of loving service are not there. The senses engaged in service to the master of the senses is not there in meditation. Not in the same way. And so their relationship of loving service is not yet fully developed in those higher planetary systems where they're seeing the Lord coming out of the fire. When the yagya is over, they don't see the Lord. When their meditation is completed, they don't see the Lord.
Is it same as person hearing from a pure devotee, but still not fully having the desire to overcome material attractions, curiosity kind of things?
I'm not sure what you're asking. You got what he's asking?
He's saying, can we compare this thing to a devotee who gets very uplifted in the presence of a pure devotee? And then because of the material attractions, he goes back to his...
Not the same. Because the platform of devotional service is not on the same platform as yajna and tapa and dhyana. There's some similarity, but it's not the same. It's just like if you take a seed that's a rose, and you plant the seed, and the seed sprouts and it grows, and when you end up, you can have a rose. So it undergoes different stages of growth and transformation. But you end up, because the seed is a rose, you end up with a rose. So in these others, the process that they're applying is not, does not have the seed of devotion, and so they may or may not end up with the rose. They'll have to undergo some very significant change in order to come to that position. Like Prabhupada describes, you've heard this example, that the yoga system is identified according to the position that one is in. If one is more or less stuck on one of the rungs of the yoga ladder, then one is identified with that yoga. Here's a karma yogi, here's a jnana yogi, here's a dhyana yogi. And for such persons, they think, that's it. So a devotee may pass through some unsteadiness, anishtita bhakti stage, but because the seed that they've been given is the seed of bhakti, well, if they simply persevere, strive by right means, as Krishna indicates in Bhagavad Gita, then they'll come to the nishtha stage of bhakti. So that anishtita bhakti is not the same as persons that are in the higher planetary systems may stay there for some time and come back down again. There's some similarity, appearance-wise, but it's the platform from which devotional service is rendered, even at our stage, is not the same. Such a devotee is more fortunate. And it's not, that's not like a sectarian sense of pride, it's just a scriptural fact. From the 8th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, we understand what happens to the unsuccessful yogi and what happens to the devotee who doesn't complete the process. One may go to some higher planets, but unless the spirit of devotion awakens, that is all, it's all impermanent. Or say it the other way, to the degree that devotion is awakened, that's permanent. Okay, I'll end with that. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki.